Welcome along to the Care Team Sessions podcast. This is a podcast of talks from our monthly CPD events. For those that aren't already familiar with us, the West Midlands Care Team is a charity pre-hospital enhanced care team operating in the Birmingham area for over 30 years now. Care Team Sessions CPD events have something for all clinical levels, from community responders right through to experienced in-hospital clinicians, along with medics from other services like police and fire. We want to share the team's knowledge and experience with you, so Care Team Sessions is free to attend or to listen back to on this podcast. It's also an opportunity to raise money for the charity, which would help us to continue to do the work we do. If you'd like a CPD certificate for listening to this podcast, we ask for a donation of £5. Details of how to donate and claim your certificate are in the podcast description. Also, don't forget to follow us on social media, search at WM Care Team. Enjoy the podcast.
Good evening, everybody. I am going to try and run through in a relatively short space of time the sort of gamut of managing for burns patients. What I'm not going to cover, because I'm nowhere near a firefighter, the kind of scene safety considerations that go into kind of burns management. So we'll sort of skip that a little bit. Just in terms of the actual pathophysiology of burns, hopefully this isn't unfamiliar to you, that the areas that of burned skin create this sort of bullseye pattern where you've got areas that unfortunately have died as a result of the burn. There's this area where the blood flow has stopped around that area of that burn. And there's the area that's kind of become inflammatory around that, a bit like the kind of sunburn effect. And unfortunately, we can do very little about the area of skin that's become burnt and has died already. And what principally our management about is trying to contain this zone of stasis to try and minimize that and try and resuscitate that area. So hopefully, spotting these areas can, you know, with nice arrows pointing out where those bits are. We've got the sort of deeper, thicker, full thickness burns, and then these areas where there's still blanching skin. Okay, and then I think this picture's a little bit better to show it. You've got areas that have died, the area around it that's got stasis in it, and then the sort of blanching skin around. Along with the area of skin that's become injured, then we get into the systemic effects of that and the severity of the injury, a bit like as we talk about with major trauma. This then starts this kind of firestorm in the body, this systemic inflammatory response that starts to accumulate a burden of injury for the patient. Then this then has a knock-on effect. The skin is a large organ of the body, but then it goes on to have effects on the heart, the lungs, the metabolic and the immune system. That, for patients that have large burns, that go on to survive, these are the challenges that they have whilst they're in hospital. Generally, burns unfortunately are increasing in their frequency. And as we see this across all age groups, as well as the severities gradually increasing. Fortunately, however, major burns have been relatively consistent. They make up approximately 5% of kind of our UK trauma that we see. But it's still about 200 burns deaths a year in the UK each year. But fortunately, we have very few burns disasters. And, you know, people may remember kind of Kegworth Air disaster, etc. But frequently, so there we go. Only three disasters with more than five patients with more than 10% burns in a 30-year period. So hopefully UK safety systems are working. So then what I'm going to try and draw your minds to now is about managing a burns patient, but we're going to talk about kind of big burns first in a way, because the priorities are then much more clinical for the patient in the kind of standard way that we think about our A's, a B's and a C's, because those are the immediate priorities. And then we'll reflect on what we'll see most of, which are smaller burns that we'll then talk about kind of immediate burns management, shall we say. So with airway burns, and I think these are probably the thing that, you know, scare most of us about, you know, big burns patients, is how to deal with their airway, because it gets reinforced to us, and I'm afraid I'm not going to dispel that too much tonight, is the difficulty is that they can go from being okay one moment and then they can be really compromised the next. So what are we looking out for that's going to try and trigger us to think, actually, this patient might have an airway burn? So we're looking for signs of inhalational injury. So that's burns that have occurred to the upper airways. We're looking for any signs of sooting in the mouth, but that actually also, that chemical irritation can result in burns to the airway as well. We'll talk about a little bit about asphyxiants and then the toxicity from some of the chemicals that can burn. But what we're principally breaking it down into is supraglottic airway burns and then infraglottic, which are extremely rare, but they have got kind of like a much different pattern and also a different course in terms of the patient's injury. So just to cover infraglottic burns, these are when patients have been in a confined space, you've had a kind of an aerosolization or a steam that's been generated, that then they actually inhale that heat. Our upper airways are pretty good at trying to dissipate that, but if you imagine, and I think I've got it later, or I was trying to find, or I was trying to find just now, if you imagine, you know, that sort of old hot water Vicks in it, and you're kind of inhaling that to actually trying to get it into your lungs to make you feel better. Well, if you imagine now that that's boiling hot chemicals, or you know the steam that's come off that's incredibly hot, it can it actually manages to bypass that upper airway and starts to burn actually lower down into the lower airways or actually into the lung tissue itself. So blast injuries, etc., and the chemicals again that can aerosolize. So then for our sort of supraglottic airway burns, what are the kind of hallmark features that we're looking at to try and pick out whether this person's got an inhalational injury? So have they got any signs of a facial burn? Have they got edema that's starting in their lips, in their mucosa, in their mouth, tongue, down the back of their throat that you can maybe have a look at? Are they presenting saying that their voice has changed or they're getting hoarse as you start to assess them? If they've got any upper airway noises or stridor, and then what's kind of a little bit more difficult sometimes to pick up from the state of some of the patients that we see is actually, have they got soot accumulating in their nostrils, in their mouth? Have they got singeing of their eyebrows, facial hair, the hairs on their head? Again, because it just puts you in mind of actually where they've been, what position they've been in when they've been exposed to whatever burn injury they've had. And then those signs, they're being tachypneic, having difficulty breathing, that kind of constant hoarsing cough that they generate, that they're trying to hack up stuff, but they just can't bring anything up. And then them starting to actually go into respiratory distress, that intercostal recession. Asphyxiants, again, these are particular chemicals that actually then starve people of oxygen. And they tend to kind of go down this cascade of becoming more and more lethargic, more and more kind of unresponsive, and then they become comatose. And so this is what I was talking about. Actually, once we start to recognize some of those risk factors for having airway burns, then that's where we may need to start to trigger either in ourselves, actually how we're going to manage this, or actually are we going to need some assistance, or do we need to hightail it to somewhere that can manage this? Because if you imagine going down your sort of normal airway ladder, well, actually, if the problem is developing so rapidly, actually trying to, you know, go through that stepwise fashion, well, even, you know, as you get to this comatose patient and that eye gel, actually they've got a huge amount of laryngeal edema already, and we're kind of a bit stuffed then. Touch a little bit about poisoning again. It become, you know, far better. I have been in this lecture theatre, you know, for the best part of the last 10 years, and the seats have changed dramatically. But I can only imagine the kind of chemicals that were in them when it was first built, you know, 30 years ago. Modern furniture, which is a predominant source of the old sort of cyanide poisoning that happened for domestic burns, have pretty much been eliminated. But it still can happen, particularly if you're in an industrial complex, that kind of thing. But it's particularly rare now in domestic settings. And so the two principal ones are carbon monoxide and cyanide. There are other weird and wonderful things, but I don't think anybody's got the patience to try and go through those. Carbon monoxide. So this can be generated, can be generated particularly from gas leaks. There's a domestic gas leak, somebody, you know, forgetting to leave the oven on, And it has that sort of, they add, it's odorless, but they add that smell to the gas that you may all recognize when pilot light's not working and you kind of keep clicking away, click, 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 and it starts to accumulate. And then you kind of go, maybe I'll just open a window before I start and try and click that again. But they go down again, a very similar pattern of losing their consciousness level, but also, unfortunately, it then starts to have a cardiovascular effect, and the myocardium then doesn't beat as well as it should. These are the kind of classical symptoms as you look at the percentage of carbon monoxide building up. Again, I don't think it would take any amount of worry as you start to get lower and lower through this. You can see how that would affect someone. And unfortunately, the treatment is high flow oxygen. We obviously want to try and displace that carbon monoxide that's bound to those red blood cells by giving them lots and lots of oxygen. If we can reduce that by giving it at much higher pressures. I don't know where the nearest hyperbaric system is, actually. I think it's something you have to kind of refer to. I'll look it up for next time. But delivering them high flow oxygen is the most important thing at that stage for their initial management. And then cyanide, talked about again, from mostly furniture burning, but other chemical settings could occur. And again, very similar. Headaches, altered mental status, then they become hypertensive, and the cardiovascular effects then kick in. There is a treatment, unfortunately, it's only carried in the sort of specialist. Paris Fire have had a long experience of using it, and I think it's something that's been integrated from the sort of European Resuscitation Council guidelines, but again, fortunately, because it's rare, as with many things in the NHS, we just don't then carry it. But what everybody has the ability to do is to recognise those signs and symptoms and then sort of flag that up so that it can be treated in the quickest way. All right, enough of those. Airway burns. Right, circulatory access. And this is a little bit of consternation that happens, particularly when you're thinking about burns resuscitation. We're thinking about, well, can we get enough fluid into these patients? Relatively well demonstrated now from the IO access routes that we'll have available to us, you can definitely do enough of resuscitation through them. And often, particularly if they've got a lot of extremity burns or they're already starting to have their cardiovascular effects, they'll become peripherally shut down, and actually getting IV access into a burns patient can be incredibly difficult. So hopefully they're not as uncommon as when I originally wrote these slides, but you know, IO access is perfectly acceptable and will be very valuable for doing fluid resuscitation for burns patients. Okay, so those are the kind of primary considerations for big burns patients. We'll touch a little bit more later on, but if I turn now to thinking about the kind of more typical burns that we'll get, you know, the child that scalded themselves, somebody who's unfortunately slipped with a hot kettle and poured it down themselves. We're looking at trying to assess the severity of that burn. And we break it down into the sort of layers or the depths that burn can occur in. So we start off with the most superficial, and this is effectively sunburn. You'll have all had it, particularly over the roasting hot days that we had recently. But it's that area where you know, skin feels a bit irritated, it's a bit red, you feel the heat on it, but the skin still blanches, it's not blistered. And then as we get further and further into that depth of burn, then that's when those features start to occur. So the top layer of the skin can start to blister or peel. That blanching effect starts to become more and more prominent, and actually the redness becomes more exposed as the layers of the skin that we all have some pigmentation in start to get worn away, and we expose the deeper layers that are very vascular and then show up that capillary blood supply. So we can break that down slightly into superficial dermal and then deep dermal. And then really when we get through the full layer of that dermis, that thick skin, when that's burnt completely, then that's what we call full thickness. And that's that area, as we talked about before, that kind of leathery appearance to the skin. It's often white, and there's no blanching, no capillary refill in it. Okay. All sounding okay so far? People seen that before? Yeah, okay. So then once we've kind of gauged the depth of the particular area, then we need to work out the body surface area. And there are lots of ways that everybody know the palm rule. I need to learn this. I should ask, has anybody not, because I'm sure it's all familiar to you, anybody not come across the palm rule? Wonderful. So then there's the rule of nine. Anybody not come across the rule of nines? Wonderful. So I can skip over most of this. We have, which we use, it's slightly more for sort of documentation purposes in hospital, but there are these sort of more accurate charts, the London Browder charts. But what's been developed off that, and I'll ask again, anybody not heard of the Mersey Burns app? Wonderful. Is there any... Say again? Yes, I have. Anybody got it on their phone right now? Wonderful. And again, it's become, you know, increasingly demonstrated that the accuracy of doing it on that app is very good. And I haven't checked it in a little while. I'm sorry, I should have. But they were trying to generate sort of integration features where you could send that off to the hospital and they would have that initial assessment. But being able to draw it out in that way can give a very accurate estimation then of the burns that they have. Based on that estimation, then we try to ascertain whether or not this would trigger the need to have burns resuscitation. Okay. What we're trying to do is to expand that intravascular volume that's, unfortunately, the huge edema that's caused by the area of burnt skin draining fluid out of the system means that they become cardiovascularly unstable. That, in effect, because the patient is becoming shocked, then causes the body to go into its natural preservative mechanisms and trying to conserve blood supply to the vital organs. And shutting off your skin is one of the first things that it wants to do. You'll have all encountered, you know, that peri-arrest patient and they're ashen grey, you know, their skin is all clammy and it's got that kind of horrible sort of waxy texture to it. And again, it's because that skin is becoming avascular. This then creates that, where that zone of stasis, so that bullseye pattern that we had before, then that area of skin is shutting down and that's going to cause that zone of coagulation that's already the blood supply is stopped into and the dead skin, that zone of stasis will then widen and that burn gets bigger. And this is what we're trying to resuscitate. So what it requires is that optimal fluid resuscitation. So where do we come into play as pre-hospital practitioners? Delayed fluids, unfortunately, whilst some is better than none, the earlier it's delivered, the more effective it is. And that's what we're trying to hone in against. So this is the balance that we're trying to strike. Under resuscitating a patient, I'm sure we'll all appreciate what happens to that. But if we then also flood them, and this is not necessarily they're not going to be flooded in the pre-hospital time period, but we know that unfortunately for burns that have excessive fluid delivery, then they go on to have long-term problems in their recovery, where the fluid starts to leach out of their system, they become fluid overloaded, it accumulates particularly on their lungs and they get acute lung injury or respiratory distress, and it can also result in cardiac failure. We come to this juxtaposition where, and unfortunately, and I'll include myself in this, we're pretty bad at judging sizes of burns pre-hospitally. You know, it's a difficult environment, we're not so keen to expose patients. Gauging exactly what's burnt, you know, is challenging, and areas that are blistered, we're sort of not checking, you know, as thoroughly as they will do when they get into hospital. However, so the tendency is that we overestimate the size of the burn. The odd thing about it is when we look back at the records for those fluid resuscitations pre-hospitally, unfortunately the delay sometimes or the rate at which the fluids are given, funnily enough, it actually balances out. So although we've overestimated, we've under-resuscitated, but actually their real burn is this level. And so our fluids are pretty bang on. I don't really want to mess with that, but as we kind of get more accurate, I think that will hopefully drive it as best we can. And then also in an effort to try and simplify this, because I'm sure you'll have all seen those sort of, you know, calculus level maths equations to try and work out, well, it's the size of the burn and they've had this much time and they need this much fluid for this body weight. Actually just simplifying it down to whether they're a big burn or a little burn, and then when they're a big person or a little person, and we're talking about adults here, not necessarily children. So for the kind of generic patient that we have, excluding children and excluding the elderly, we're thinking about 500 mils in an hour for a little person, little burn, but we only trigger burn resuscitation at 20%. So 20 to 50%, we're looking at 500 mils. And then our big burn, big patient, we're looking at a litre. And then you can easily split the two now, can't you, to 750. And that's not a huge amount, is it? You know, you'll easily administer that over an hour. But the sooner the better. And that's the key challenge that we all have when you encounter these patients. We're going to go down a period of cooling that we'll talk about in a moment, but then actually giving any resuscitation fluid in a timely manner. This is the piece of work that generated that kind of statement for 20 minutes of cool water cooling. And you can see I'm going to spend just a tiny amount of time just to show this. So the yellow bars are healed skin, purple was no change, and then the green is where it became worse. And you've got control group. So running water with 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Okay. And the biggest percentage improvement comes in this 20 minute category. All right. And actually the overcooling, because you think, well, actually I'll just keep cooling it. But again, it just gets to that tipping point, and I'm sure, you know, 18 minutes versus 22 minutes, like nobody's done that study. But it's just about that area of cooling that's being achieved before the skin then actually starts to shut down again. It's taking away enough of the heat out of the skin to allow it to become revascularized. So then how are we going to achieve that? And it's going to need to be, unfortunately, just getting the water bottle out of the back of the car isn't going to cut it, really. In order to try and achieve 20 minutes of cooling for a significant area of the body, is going to need either hose pipe, shower, you know, putting them in the bath, running under the cold tap of the kitchen sink. You're going to need some source of water to achieve that. And that can often be built into how you initially manage that patient. Where are you going to get them to that's going to allow you to do that? Okay, and if that means actually going back upstairs into their bathroom to be able to do that, then that might be the best way to do that, rather than trying to do a bit under the sink and then, okay, then I try and get your leg into the sink. Like, if you need to take them back upstairs into a slightly more cumbersome area, then do that to try and achieve the cooling. Sorry, I'll just recap that. The cooling effect has benefit up to 3 hours. So we want to do it as soon as we can. You know, I think that sort of goes with a lot of our medical intervention. As soon as we can do it, we want to do it. Once it's gone past 3 hours, then there might be some other considerations that actually, firstly thinking, why is it taking this long for somebody to present to medical care? But then actually, we might be better off looking at some of the other management aspects. We can try and do a bit of cooling, but actually once you're at that 3 hour mark, that injury is probably as static as it's going to be, and then good analgesia and then getting them to the right centre for care is probably more important than spending half an hour on scene trying to achieve some degree of cooling for them. So this is, again, probably not going to make too much sense, but so the burn cooling doesn't make patients cold, but burns injuries do make them cold. And hypothermia for burns patients, particularly when we're talking about big burns, has a significant mortality effect. And we want to be actively warming them. Yeah, sounds crazy, doesn't it? On one hand, we're trying to cool patients. On the other hand, we're trying to warm them up. But we're trying to look at active warming techniques. So that's warmed fluids, body heat preservation, blankets, etc., into the core areas of the body where they'll start to lose heat from. Peter already stole my thunder, the key message around burns dressings. So we had all the hydrogels and all those things. And unfortunately, they're a great idea. Like, I would love for them to work because they're magic, aren't they? You've got something in a packet that you can put on a burn that makes it better. Like, that would be fantastic, wouldn't it? And I hope they keep persevering and trying to create it. But unfortunately, the designs that they've had meant that they need to be exposed in order to have an air current across them to have a cooling effect. And what are they? Really slippery. So what happens? You slap them on, and then what do you do? pick them up off the floor because they've fallen off. And so you put it back on again. And then what you do? You get K-band dressing and you wrap it around to like secure it on. And that means that they then become insulators. And at worst, they do nothing. At best, they do nothing. And at worst, they actually trap the heat in the skin. So that's why they were kind of not recommended for burns management. But what we do want to do is try and cover the burns for some degree of sterility. These are essentially an open source into the patient's bloodstream. And if we can try and decontaminate them, hopefully that large amount of clean water being poured on them will do a lot of decontamination. But then actually being able to get some covering on it, and that simple cling film dressing will do just that, okay? Just be mindful of it. It's not our, you know, Sunday dinner that we want to save for Monday. It doesn't need to like get fully wrapped, because what will happen is the extremity swells, then it becomes quite constricting. And that will again damage the blood supply that we're trying to preserve in the skin. So a single layer, okay, or a loosely applied circumferential, that you want to keep checking as well, because as you know, extremities can swell quite a lot. But the importance point of this is about recognition. So if patients have got circumferential, near circumferential burns, particularly to their torso, then that leathery skin can start to act like a straitjacket that then stops their chest expanding, and then it makes them having difficulty breathing. Okay, this needs to be kind of a very emergent trigger that they're going to need to be in a centre of either definitive care, or they're going to have advanced interventions, you know, at scene or within a very short space of time. So the treatment of which is just to actually incise the burnt area of skin so that it releases that, and so that the chest wall can move. So hopefully the kind of some of the big hitters from the talk that I'd wish for you to leave from today, if I haven't rambled too badly. Burns cooling, the other one is pain management. Okay, unfortunately, it's universally poorly done, particularly in burns patients. Obviously, they can be very distracting injuries, and there's a lot of anxiety about them. But unfortunately, the adage that full thickness burns aren't painful still is quite pervasive, and it's just not true. Whilst that area that's been burnt will be insensate, if I bring you back again to the bullseye analogy, all of that area around it that's a zone of stasis is still sensate, or is potentially still sensate if we can resuscitate it. And there's a huge source. So the size of the burn, there's that penumbra around it, that area all around it that's going to generate pain for the patient. And so that's what we're trying to manage for. And I think when I was kind of taught that, and I then understood that as a concept, you can see how incredibly painful burns will be. We try not to use non-steroidal anti-inflammatories for big burns patients because of the potential. They're already unfortunately going to have problems with their kidneys as a result of all of this firestorm that's happening inside them. So trying to not give them medications that already have effects on their kidneys is preferential. Another category, and this is sort of my segue into it, the worst category of patient for their pain management are kids. And again, I think that is pretty sort of pan-trauma for cases. Children's pain management is very poorly done, and you know, we often think, oh, they're just crying because they're anxious, but their pain is real. So children, so there's 25,000 A&E attendances for children with burns injuries, of which almost 4,000 result in an admission. 50% of these will be scalds. And you can imagine how easily it happens, doesn't it? Child pulls something down off the counter, as a new parent as well, distracted, hot water, forgetting to check the cold taps on, dunking them in the bath. Yeah, they do happen. There's a slight change to the drawing, and again, I think the Mersey Burns app has a kids version that you slide along to, but just because they have a disproportionately large head. Not that they're not humble, but they've just got a disproportionately large head, so that takes up a bigger body surface area for them. And yeah, I think I've laboured this, but children still need analgesia. The other category of vulnerable patients that we should all be aware of, for very similar reasons as to the children. So 10% of the burns patients that we'll see will be over 65. And whilst their injury pattern is very similar to the rest of the adult patients that we'll see, they unfortunately go on to have a very stormy course, and they've got a 10 times higher rate of dying for their percentage burn. So whilst there's nothing kind of critical that changes for managing elder patients, just being conscious of all those kind of standard things, their medical comorbidity, their lack of physiological reserve, the likelihood that they will be more malnourished and therefore their potential to become hypothermic is much higher. Their tolerance of fluid administration will be lessened. And that's where that kind of big burn, little burn, big patient, just be mindful about how much fluid you're titrating to them if they're particularly got medical comorbidity. But the key feature that I want to stress to you all between kids and elder patients, and the same for any vulnerable adult group, is the risk of non-accidental injury. The reason that it's so important that you think about it, because often the eye won't see what the mind is not thinking. And unfortunately, there are a lot of clues that will be seen in a patient's domestic environment that you as pre-hospital practitioners are the only person that will ever encounter that. Yeah. Unfortunately, a social worker going in will happen much, much later. So having your kind of spidey senses alert to those, particularly in these vulnerable patient groups, are critical, because there will be bits that you will pick up that will allow for further investigation. It's not to say that you kind of go in and immediately go, did you do this to your child? But if you just have that sort of mindfulness, how is the story consistent each time that the parent tells it? Are what you saw, you know, similar? You know, this child that's only this high and the countertops are like these nice high marble ones. Well, how did the child reach up there? And the other side, which will be more than likely, even it's not accidental, but picking up on features that were actually, you were upstairs doing something and the child was left with a hot iron. It's an accident, but it's preventable. And these are the things that, again, you can look at to try and stress to pick up. Last bit that I'll just flash you, because they're rather rare, aren't they? And particularly for our geographical region where we don't have a huge amount of chemical works. Chemical burns come in two flavours. They can either be from acids or from bases. And I'm sure we all remember GCSE physics with the periodic table, or chemistry even. Particular agents that ones might encounter, obviously they're some from conflict zones that hopefully we don't see back from the Eastern Europe recently. But some of the common sites, the one I was intrigued to learn about was, unfortunately, it's not an explosive, but when airbags go off, there's the powder that's contained within, that can be an skin irritant, okay? And particularly if it gets into sort of mucosal region, particularly around the eyes, it can be very irritating. For the chemical burns, we go about the same assessment. So we want to work out the percentage area. We want to think about, has there been anything gone into their eye? And then the same consideration that we talked about, inhalational injury, but also has there been any ingestion, okay, of that? And unfortunately, with mental health being as poor as it is at the moment, thinking about ingested chemical burns from somebody drinking something that they shouldn't have drunk. Yeah. So bits of vital information that we're trying to find out, that again, if you don't get it, there isn't really a chance in hell that anybody else is going to pick that up. So noting down what bottles and powders and stuff were there at the scene, what the manager or the shift coordinator brings you out for this like pile of paperwork from, like, well, these are all the like chemical safety notices that we have, and you've got like a stack of paper like this. Well, yeah, try and get them to narrow it down as best they can. What were they doing at the time? What should they have been using? and potentially what might have been mixed up with. What was the route of exposure, time, the volume, and then is there any other injuries? So like they fall off some scaffolding into a pool that's just had chlorine, you know, disinfectant poured into it, and they get covered in the stuff, and now they're, you know, bright yellow and got superpowers or something. This is where there's a bit of scene safety, even on an individual level. Just be mindful of that kind of transmission of the chemical burn. So having your own PPE as appropriate, yeah. And being mindful that you don't want to contaminate yourself. But then going about exactly the same route of primary survey, decontaminate the patient as best we can. The other difference that comes with chemical burns is that the vast majority of the kind of decontamination can be achieved by irrigation. But this is going to be as quickly as possible for as long as you can kind of reasonably do it. So while we said 20 minutes before, actually, if we can, you know, if the patient is relatively safe, relatively well, until they stop complaining of symptoms potentially, is a useful sort of chronometer of how long we want to keep going for. Obviously, you don't want to be there for like half a day. So there's got to be a transition point where you kind of go, okay, I think we're going to need to go now. There are some chemical agents that work as buffers. They're not regularly carried. Because a lot of the publicity of the acid attacks that happened in London a few years ago, like there was a lot of concern and, you know, there were lots of bottles of water carried in the back of police cars and specialist vehicles. But I think if we highlight previously kind of how much fluid you're going to need, sort of 100 litres plus to irrigate a significant area of the body. You know, it's quite difficult to carry that much, isn't it? Be mindful with them, fully expose them. And again, unfortunately, the patient's modesty in a chemical burn can give them, you know, serious problems, particularly females keeping bra or underwear on. The chemical pools in that area, and because we want to try and preserve modesty, then patients end up with deep burns because that the fabric is still in contact with their skin, and even trying to wash through it, it sticks in there. So yeah, as best you can to preserve dignity, but you know, those are the kind of considerations that you might need to make. Okay, it's a bold call, but you need to take everything off, wash you down as best we can, and then redress and think about hypothermia management. Just for, you know, fine minutiae, just at the very end, the only thing that we don't want to put water on is metal alkalis. Okay, when are you going to encounter this? I guess some school chemistry lesson, maybe when the teachers decided to do something a bit wacky and hasn't done their full risk assessment, brief the headmaster of what's going on, or again in a industrial incident, they need mineral oil to come off. Otherwise, anybody seen potassium in water? Yeah, big. The only other one to be considered, and again, not that any of us are carrying it, but the buffer is in the kind of early stages of the literature showing good effects for eye burns. So ocular chemical burns being buffered is actually better than them being irrigated. So it's not to say don't irrigate them, but it might be something in the future that during your careers may change, that actually chemical buffers are used for eye wash. And in some of the northeast where there's a lot of chemical works, they've got them, their little like individual first aid pack that each of the workers has to carry. So if you get to a big factory type setting, again, you can ask them, do they have any buffer solution for the chemicals that they carry? And then for particularly if they've got eye wash versions, again, get them to use that. They hopefully have had the training for it, or like with EpiPens, you don't know what it is because there's so many different brands. Just read the label and it says on them how to use it.
That's it for this Care Team Sessions podcast. You'll find information on how to get your CPD certificate in the podcast description. If you've enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss any future episodes. You can also follow us on social media at WM Care Team. Thanks for listening.